PR, government,
just delivering propaganda,
government affiliated information services, corporate affiliated PR, like that has a, at this point a higher likelihood of taking over our information diet.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I will say, speaking of glimmers of hope, there was a big, just to put a button on this, a big other tech giant, Google, that was also legislated by this new government legislation, and they did agree to pay for news content on their platform. So they're giving Canadian news media $100 million annually, and the media outlets are currently deciding how that money is going to be divvied up. So there's a little bit of hope there, too.
And full disclosure, while Canada Land will not take government media subsidies, we are very happy to take Google's money, and we hope to be paying part of our reporters' salaries and paychecks with it soon.
I'd be happy to take that $100 million off your hands. Ka-ching.
Kevin, this was baffling and stupefying and fascinating. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to bring it to you.
That is your Canada Land. I can be emailed at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything that you send. Today's episode was reported and presented by Kevin O'Keefe. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Audio production and editing from Tristan Capicchione. Max Collins is our production manager. Fact-checking by Noor Azrieh. Our theme music is by So Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. I'm Jesse Brown, and today we're talking about the news. I know a bit about how to talk about Israel news and about Palestine news. But Lebanon news? During an expanding war? I might need some help with that. And today, you will hear me get it. Host of our weekly politics edition, you can hear it every Tuesday. Welcome back to the show, Noor Azrieh.
Thanks, Jesse.
Charred, blackened, and crumbling neighborhoods after earth-shaking airstrikes lit up the night sky.
Israel says it took out roughly 100 loaded rocket launchers and killed several top Hezbollah commanders.
Those strikes across Lebanon would continue as it pursues Hezbollah.
That part of the Lebanese capital is a stronghold for Hezbollah.
Known to be a stronghold for the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah.
This is not a Shia Muslim area where Hezbollah has stronger support, but a majority Christian region.
Noor, I'm so glad you're here. We are reading more and more about what's happening in Lebanon. I think that the focus has shifted. We still need to pay attention to what's happening in Gaza, but the level of hostilities and warfare and the politics of it, like, we need to know and keep track on a day-to-day basis. And I'm reading in some places that this might go on for a very long time. And the truth of the matter is, on this program where we do media criticism and I'm trying to make sense of media about Lebanon, I have a blind spot. I do not have context. I have been following like the press wars and the press tropes and the complaints about press when it comes to Israel, Palestine for years. I have a pretty firm grasp of the issues. I know what Israelis complain about, how they're singled out by the press, that there's more reporters per square mile in Israel than anywhere else in the world, and double standards. I know what Palestinians and their supporters complain about, the use of the passive voice and the way that Palestinian life is denigrated in the press. Like, I know how to take apart a news story about Israel-Palestine. I do not have that context when it comes to Lebanon. Mm-hmm. Can you help me?
Of course I can help you.
My Lebanese colleague, my journalistic colleague, where shall we begin?
Maybe let's start at the very beginning. It all started on October 8th, 2023, when Hezbollah launched missiles at Israel. I knew that Lebanon was going to be pulled into a really bad all-out war. And at the time, the Israeli attacks were localized to southern Lebanon, a place in Lebanon that even Lebanese people often ignore. But they hit neighborhoods, they hit agriculture, and nobody in Canadian media was really paying attention about the impacts of the war then on October 8th, 9th, and the days that followed. It was more characterized as like some kind of tit-for-tat situation. This is the first time I'm consuming news and consuming Western analysts and Western media about a war from a place that I'm from. Mm-hmm. I've only been in Canada for a few years. And I think what I've learned thus far after a year of consuming this stuff is, okay, yeah, holy shit, they think we're all terrorists and like everything is justified to them. And we've had journalists talk about this like underlying feeling of like all Arabs, Arab journalists feeling dehumanized in the media, something that you brought up about Palestinian people. And I think that's a thing that we feel as well. But I'm not here to talk about emotions. I'm here to talk about media criticism.
Yeah. So what media gives you that?
Yeah, let's talk about it. Get your notebook, write this down. I have been reading the CBC, and let me read you just a few lines from a few articles. Here's one article. I'll read a line. A few days ago, he was managing a bakery in the southern suburbs referred to as the Dahiya, known as a Hezbollah stronghold in Beirut. Here's another line. The Israel Defense Forces widened its ground incursion in Lebanon and launched strikes at what it says are Hezbollah targets in Beirut's southern suburbs. And here's the last one. The pagers exploded in southern Lebanon in Dahiya and the east Nab'ah Valley, southern suburbs of Beirut that are known as Hezbollah strongholds. Look, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that any of these lines are inherently untrue, but I want to unpack the kind of messaging this language is sending to me, even if it's unintentional.
Mm-hmm.
When we hear words like Hezbollah, we think terrorist, bad, and it's like playing into our bias that Hezbollah is bad. And then when you hear words like Hezbollah stronghold, the association then becomes terrorists with other terrorists doing things that relate to terrorism.
Tonight, CBC News travels into Hezbollah territory.
Hezbollah still controls access to the area known as the Dahiya.
Israeli jets struck again in Hezbollah's stronghold in southern Beirut.
Smoke above the Hezbollah stronghold, a near constant.
And I think it's the same kind of pattern that we saw when the media was using the language of Hamas-controlled Gaza Health Ministry. Again, yes, Hamas is the governing body that oversees Gaza's health ministry. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that's not true. But what the language is doing is subtly telling you Hamas, bad terrorists, anything that they control is thus unreliable. It's signaling something, even if it's unintentional and even if it's true.
I know what you mean, but I don't know how else you would report these things. I think that, you know, I'm not sure it's the right analogy because when the media talks about the Hamas Ministry of Health, it's usually in the context of how many people were killed.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to cite your source. Like, mm-hmm. who says this? You know, and that is the Hamas's, sometimes they say the Gazan Health Ministry.
Which is better. When the war first started,
yeah.
I kept seeing Hamas-controlled Gazan Health Ministry. And now I've been seeing a shift where even we here at Canada Land have changed our language from saying Hamas-controlled Gazan Health Ministry, and we've settled on Gazan Health Ministry. It's not inaccurate. It is the Gazan Health Ministry.
I'm okay with either term. I agree with you that when you say it's the Hamas Health Ministry, some listeners will be like, oh, Hamas, well, they lie.
Mm-hmm.
And I think by the same token, if you say Israel's Department of Health reports blah, 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 some people are going to think, well, that's Israel. They lie. And the fact of the matter is that in war, governments lie.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And if we want to give the most accurate information possible, we should not be trying to suggest to people that government information is infallible and is solid. So rather than trying to make the information seem more objective, I think we need to just cite our sources really diligently. But I don't think it's the right analogy for the point you're making, because I think that the point you're making is more analogous to when the media says Israel struck a target in in Gaza, which Israel says was used by Hamas for X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
Israel says its precise airstrike targeted a building which contained a command and control center for Hamas. But local officials say children were housed here.
It's the same thing when they say that this is a Hezbollah target, is this was a fair target. This was a good target. This was a military target, which might be true, but it does serve to underplay the extent to which these are also often civilian areas.
Hitting what Israel's military claims were hundreds of Hezbollah targets, including people's homes, where the Israeli military says the militant group kept missiles and ammunition.
And sometimes it's like, well, we're just taking Israel's word for it that there was some military purpose for this. And we certainly know that a lot of civilians were killed.
But I think the general public, people unlike you and me who don't consume that much news, who are reading the headlines, who are, you know, skimming the pages, don't read Israel's health ministry and think liars, because the general public doesn't associate Israel as a terrorist state, but we do associate Hamas with terrorism. In that way, I feel like it is different.
Well, Hamas is a registered terrorist entity in Canada.
And no one is denying that.
Yeah. No, look, I think that there are plenty of people who do not trust Israel and who, when they see the name, like, and a growing number of people. But I do take your point that it's not just apples to apples, but that might be because they are different.
I want to get back to the Hezbollah stronghold of it all. Here is the reality. The Dahiyeh, the so-called Hezbollah stronghold, isn't some like remote terrorist encampment off the side of a mountain. The Dahiyeh has neighborhoods. Like, my grandmother is from southern Lebanon. People live here, were born here, they raise their families here. And the media, I think, does a really fantastic job of flattening people's understanding of these places, because these neighborhoods that people live and go to school and work in are just mere strongholds or militant bases. And I think that what that language does is dehumanize Arab suffering, because let's be real, if you think someone did a bad thing or was associated with a bad thing and they are dead, you feel less bad about it. It's easier to feel less empathetic when you feel like, okay, these people died in the fight against terrorism in this stronghold of terrorism.
Collateral damage in a greater war for good over evil. Our countries have a really in-depth relationship, and there's like, how many, what are the numbers? How many?
Oh my God, we're everywhere.
Hundreds of thousands of Lebanese Canadians, Canadian Lebanese.
Totally.
Hundreds of thousands. And what little I know about Lebanon is that it is complicated, that you have Druze and Christian Lebanese and Shiites and Sunnis.
We have so many political parties. Our identities are so incredibly diverse. And when I come here and I'm talking, I don't talk on behalf of all Lebanese people. We are so incredibly different. I'm talking about me and how I've been consuming this news, how my family's been consuming the news. So yeah, I do want to preface that.
This is always the conundrum with these things, is that we do need to hear the voices of Lebanese people, and yet no Lebanese person can speak for all Lebanese people. Do you think that the media is doing a better job than they used to?
Let me talk to you a bit about 2006, because I think it's really important in the context of today. This is not the first time Canadian media has been covering a war in Lebanon with Israel. The Canadian media was very, very much paying close attention to the war in 2006 because Canada was involved to a much larger degree in the evacuation efforts. They went way beyond the kind of pathetic tweets that we're seeing now. Canada helped evacuate almost 15,000 people from Lebanon. Some of them are foreign nationals. They spent close to $94 million and leased 7 ships to help with the evacuations. 3 naval ships participated in the operation. And even the damn prime minister's jet was roped into service, a war that the prime minister at the time, Stephen Harper, supported. But the reason 2006 is important is because it prompted this awful reaction in the Canadian media. We can thank Conservative MP Garth Turner for popularizing this term, Canadians of Convenience, on his blog in 2006 to describe Canadians living in Lebanon.
Who is a Canadian? What are the obligations of us to go and rescue people who are dual citizens? And what are their obligations to Canada?
2006 was very different where, you know, what are you supposed to do when Canadian citizens are in a war zone? You're supposed to evacuate them. And Canada, even under Harper, supportive of the war, did that and sort of spared no expense to do that. But he paid a political cost because the media bashed this. It was like, what are you bothering to save these people for? They're barely even Canadian. They're Canadians of convenience.
The media reaction that followed prompted the government to change and amend the Citizenship Act in 2009 to create two tiers of citizenship where one lower class cannot pass on their citizenship, a change that, by the way, has recently been deemed unconstitutional, and they have to change back.
Which is why the courts ruled that the cutoff rule for second-generation Canadians was unconstitutional. My question to the Honourable Member is, for Canadians of convenience, how does he imagine that they so cleverly plan ahead to choose their parents so that they can then claim Canadian citizenship?
Now, a passport is a passport is a passport. Totally. A citizen is a citizen is a citizen, like everywhere else.
Yeah, it's insane. But I do think that if Canada were to conduct like a full-scale evacuation like it did in 2006 and spend a ton of money like it did, we'd see a similar reaction. We're already seeing increased instances of anti-Arab hate and Islamophobia.
And we're seeing a government that doesn't seem willing to take the same risk because what if they, like you said, it's just a bunch of tweets and saying, hey, get out on your own speed if you can, you know?
Extremely pathetic.
We ain't helping you. And no massive.
Good luck, babe.
No massive evacuation. So is the coverage better and are we hearing from the right people? Because in 2006, it was a lot of people talking about Lebanese Canadians. And I know how important it is to hear from Lebanese Canadians, but I've been told you're going to have trouble booking them because they are afraid to speak. Like, they all hate Hezbollah, and they're all afraid to speak out against Hezbollah. Is that true?
Okay. Hezbollah has a well-documented negative relationship, adversarial relationship with journalists. They resort to harassment, intimidation, even physical violence for those who cover the party critically in Lebanon. They've employed a range of tactics, physical threats. You know, they're trying to suppress and control their image. But I think the reluctance to speak out isn't coming from journalists on the ground. Lebanese journalists, Palestinian journalists, they have put themselves in harm's way to ensure the Western media and the world is seeing what is going on. Issam Abdullah was killed doing his job over a year ago now. Journalists in the Arab world have been much braver than journalists in the West. I have found myself at times reluctant to speak out, not out of a fear of Hezbollah.
So why?
Two reasons. There is a well-organized, well-funded, pro-Israel lobby group that regularly defames journalists who are critical of Israel. They launch newsroom complaints. They call for journalists to be fired. They tarnish people's reputations. People either avoid talking about Israel or tread lightly. You've had guests on this show who have been targets of these campaigns. I'm probably going to be a target of this campaign.
I've been called out by Honest Reporting.
Another reason why I am reluctant to come on the air and talk about this is because I think we've seen that the media has done an incredible job of flattening people's perceptions about Arabs, about the way we live, about how our politics are. And there is a tendency to paint us as emotional, as reactive. And as a journalist, I don't want that. I'd rather avoid putting myself in a position where I'm going to be labeled as something that I'm not and just sit it out.
I'm glad you're not sitting it out. I'm glad you're here talking to me now. I do see some signs of an interest in hearing other voices. I like definitely more than in 2006. It seems like there are Lebanese Canadians who are willing to speak, and there is interest from mainstream media in hearing those voices. I know Dania Asaf's piece in the Globe and Mail.
Yeah, I read it. It's a beautiful piece.
I found it just nice to hear somebody, like in a human way, writing about what Lebanon is to him as a Lebanese Canadian. He talks about the tiny village of Lala, where he spent his summers with his grandparents. Reading from the piece, I vividly recall the valley's terraced, red-earth Mediterranean hills studded with abundant cherry, olive, and fig trees, and the vast blue skies and captivating landscapes, where its tranquility is its treasure.
There's a line about you can ski at night and swim in the day or whatever. Read that one.
Read that about Vancouver.
This article is every stereotype you've ever heard about Lebanon in one sitting.
In Beirut, in normal times, you can ski in the morning, go to the beach on the Mediterranean in the afternoon, and have a glamorous night out for food and fun amongst the stylish locals until dawn. Use the coupon below for 20% off your flight to Beirut. It is the original city that never sleeps. I added a line in the middle there.
What it makes me think about is... this, have you ever heard of the guy Edward Said?
Yes.
Edward Said, the man who coined the term Orientalism to describe the way the West others and exoticizes non-Western cultures like the Middle East. Lebanon, I think, suffers this like unique fate of being digestible to the West. We're seen as like more sympathetic victims. We cannot tolerate the suffering of Lebanese people, but for some reason the suffering of other Arabs is never seen as the same as the suffering of Lebanese people. When the war like really unfolded in Lebanon, I felt a turn in a lot of people where it was like, oh wow, this is unacceptable, you know? And again, I'm not going to sit here and say it's not unacceptable. But it was also unacceptable before. But I think it's because Lebanon, it's like a blend of exoticism, but like has this Western positioning. It's idealized in this way that it's like, we have Western values. We have Christians here, God damn it. We're the Paris of the Middle East. Like, what?
I heard
Prime
that
Minister Benjamin Netanyahu literally said, Lebanon, the pearl of the Middle East.
This is a message to the people of Lebanon. Do you remember when your country was called the pearl of the Middle East?
We drink, we party, we speak English, our food is popular, we rah-rah, the West loves us. And don't get me wrong, I love Lebanon too. I look at pictures of Lebanon every day and romanticize a version of it in my head. But there is just something so incredibly unique about how the West sees and writes about Lebanon. It is digestible. These people are like us. And I think part of it has to do with the fact that there are so many Lebanese Canadians here. And I find myself as a diaspora Lebanese person romanticizing a version of Lebanon that isn't really true.
I think I understand what you're saying. It's very complicated. Because it does not surprise me that people, A, relate more to people who they know and have relationships with and interact with. The fact that there are so many Lebanese people in Canada, Montreal and Toronto, you know, the fact that when you know someone, you see their humanity. That's a good thing. And it's harder to other them. Relationships build empathy. And it's kind of a, like, why would you be mad about that? I understand why you're mad about that. You don't want to benefit from a compassion that is denied to other Arab people. I understand that. I do think that there's a Western chauvinism that I don't want to make excuses for anything, but I understand. I remember I had like a music teacher, who's like a jazz musician, who's like, I love Beirut, man. It's the Paris of the Middle East.
I literally have heard that line.
Yeah.
My father tells me this line every day. So it's like even something that we do to ourselves, where we align ourselves so much with the West.
There's so much cruelty and lack of compassion in the world that I don't think you can turn away from any good feeling in this horrible time that we're living in. But I think that your impulse to try to extend it to others is a good one. I still read stuff that I roll my eyes at. The Globe and Mail, Eric Reguli, I want to point this piece out to you.
Yes.
The Lebanese are used to war, deprivation, wealth destruction, mass protests, and political chaos. Life goes on, sort of, in a country that has not felt like a real country in decades. This time, there is a palpable sense of fear or doom even as Israel and Iran-backed militant group Hezbollah bombard each other. And this is a piece about how it might be a good thing. I'm simplifying it, but that, like, what he argues in this piece, this is the European bureau chief of the Globe and Mail, they're really taking Hezbollah apart. And it is true that Hezbollah is hated by a lot of Lebanese people.
A lot of Lebanese people, but it's also loved by a lot.
It is.
It's really hard.
But that maybe there's a better future. And it sort of feels like in bad taste to suggest at a time when Lebanese citizens are being killed that this might work out pretty well. But I'm also like a soulless creature of a newsroom who's like, yeah, maybe. Like Hezbollah's not great. Largest militia in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Offensive strikes against their neighbor. Like, don't a lot of Lebanese people hope that like a normalization of relations with Israel is possible if there isn't some long drawn out occupation, which is probably going to happen? Like there actually could be a westernization and a return to the Paris of the Middle East. Like, is this not?
Is that an ideal we're going
with? Is that a good thing? I don't know. Is that, do you dare to dream or is that the wrong dream?
I don't know. When I read this piece, I was like, oh, this person definitely watched Prime Minister Netanyahu's address to Lebanon and then wrote this and was like, oh my God, maybe this guy has great ideas. What if we escalate to de-escalate?
I say to you, the people of Lebanon, free your country from Hezbollah so that this war can end. Free your country from Hezbollah so that your country could prosper again, so that future generations of Lebanese and Israeli children will know neither war nor bloodshed, but will finally live together in peace.
Escalate our way to peace.
Like, does that mean,
Let's war our way to peace.
And look, there are a lot of people in Lebanon who are praying for the downfall of Hezbollah. But I don't think it justifies a war. And the death of civilians, the destruction of civilian infrastructure, I don't think it's worth it. And beyond the moral argument, according to international law, attacks that cause excessive civilian casualties or damage to civilian infrastructure are war crimes.
Noor, this is a hard thing I've asked you to do, to come in and talk about like the entire history, a whole framework of...
I could go on forever.
You don't have to do it all in one sitting. I'm really grateful that you're here talking with me now, and you work here. So can you continue to contribute to my understanding of this, whether it's sort of like in just like having your resource in the newsroom or maybe even coming back on the show at some point?
Yeah, totally. But next time I need you to bring a notebook and a pen.
Noor, it is time to duly note stories that need to be duly noted. Have you one?
Yes, I do. Fatima Syed, a reporter for The Narwhal, someone I used to work with.
Original host of our politics show.
Correct. She wrote this incredible piece for The Star that published over the weekend. I'm going to read a few lines. My phone has become a miniature record of what's happening in Gaza. I know I'm not alone in creating this kind of journal. Western mainstream media coverage has too often failed to fairly and accurately document what's happening in Gaza. So people have taken it upon themselves to convert live oral history into precarious digital record. It's been really hard watching this war unfold from our screens, something I know that we've talked about, Jesse. As a journalist, it's like I'm trying to keep track of everything that I'm seeing on my phone. My bookmarks page on Twitter is like pages and pages long. I've just found it increasingly overwhelming to keep track of, but I think it's important that we keep talking about documenting this stuff. This is, I think, the first war I've seen play out from my phone the way it has. Mm-hmm. It's been a really big struggle trying to find a way to make sense of all of it. And I think as journalists, it's important that we just keep track of everything that we're seeing, even when we don't see it in the mainstream media.
This is fundamental. The responsibility to bear witness is fundamental. A record of what's happening is fundamental. And it's really hard because there is no making sense of the images that are reaching us. Duly noted. That's our show for today. Thank you for joining me, Noor.
Thank you for having me.
Anybody can email me about what they heard. I'm at jesse@canadaland.com. Of course, everybody can hear you every week on Tuesday on our Politics Edition. But if people want to reach you, where can they find you?
You can email me at noor@canadaland.com, or you can find me on Twitter at noorazriyat97.
Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.